Are you ready to rock? Are you ready to roll into this with us, Ruth?
Sure, of course. Yeah, let's do it.
And welcome to A Little Too Quiet. It's the Ferndale Library Podcast. It's brought to you by the friends of the Ferndale Library. My name is Jeff, and I am joined, as I usually am, by Mary Graham. Hey, Mary Graham.
Hello, hello.
What's up?
That was so cool.
I know. We literally just wrapped an interview, which you're going to hear in about 30 seconds, because it was with Ruth Behar, a Cuban-American author and anthropologist, joining us from what appeared to be, over Zoom, her very academic, astute office on the campus of the University of Michigan.
She's a MacArthur genius.
Yes,
indeed. I know the MacArthur Foundation is like, that's not, don't, no, you have to put it in quotations. It's not what it's called, but she has won.
Yes,
what
indeed.
We colloquially call the MacArthur Genius Grant.
Indeed, an author of not just wonderful books for middle grade readers, middle grade fiction, but also literary fiction, memoir, poetry. She's kind of done everything, but we're having her on because you, Mary Graham, and a lot of folks in our youth department are big fans of her recent books, Letters from Cuba.
I'm a big fan of Letters from Cuba. Everett, the head of the department, loves Lucky Broken Girl.
Lucky Broken Girl.
And Ruth just came out with Across So Many Seas back earlier this year, which is, well, she'll tell us what it's about, but it spans centuries of women in a single family across many seas, many countries.
Yeah.
And I thought it was absolutely fabulous. So I loved talking to her about it.
And I think Ruth, from what she implied in her interview, has been in Ann Arbor for quite a little while now, despite having kind of lived all over the world. And I think what she does wonderfully well is blend all this, which we talk a lot about, her background in anthropology, into all the research and the historical fiction, but also just really compelling characters, poignant stories.
It's just, they're just dang good books.
They're just
really, no matter
dang heckin'
how
good
old
books
you are, which is my favorite thing about what, for me, the best of the best children's literature is stuff that I enjoy wholeheartedly as an adult and would have enjoyed wholeheartedly as a child as well if I'd read it then. So
coming up now is our chat with Ann Arbor's own Ruth Behar. Here it is.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here with you on this beautiful spring day in Michigan.
Yeah. And how are things in Ann Arbor? You're in Ann Arbor right now. How's it going?
Yeah, it's nice. It's sunny. Everything looks like it's about to bloom and daffodils are out, very beautiful yellow, the day after the eclipse, you know, so it's fun. It's great.
We sure do know. We had so many phone calls yesterday from folks asking if we still had eclipse glasses. And we did not. And so one of my stalwart coworkers took it upon herself to sit by the phone at the circulation desk. And about 270 times she answered the phone and said, "Ferndale Library, we do not have eclipse glasses. Is there anything else I can help you with today?" And she kept track, did a tally sheet of every phone call she answered. And we all lived. But it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Ruth, congrats on the fairly recent book that we have here in our hands.
I have it too, and I have it as well, right here.
Across So Many Seas.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also in Spanish. For anybody that might want to read it in Spanish, A Través de los Mares.
I think so. I order all of the non-English children's books, and I know we've got Tia Fortuna and Letters from Cuba. And I don't think I realized the Spanish edition was out yet, so I will be purchasing that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it came out on March 19th,
okay.
So it's a very new publication. So that's super, super exciting.
That is fabulous. As one of the youth librarians here, so excited to have you on. Just because I love, first of all, I loved the book, absolutely. And it was such, I always, as an adult, enjoy encountering books that I know I would also have loved as a child and that I still love as an adult. And I would have absolutely lost my mind over this book as a kid. I've always loved historical fiction. I've always loved books that cover multiple eras. I loved Letters from Cuba because it's epistolary, which was another thing I always loved as a kid.
Correction, she said I would have lost my mind. I think you did still lose your mind over it. I think,
well, yes, but I'm not 12 anymore.
You did, yeah, but
if still... if we had a time machine situation and you'd handed this book to 12-year-old me, like, I think I would have loved it just as much.
Oh yeah.
And so I would love to talk to you about just the process of this book. I know that it's based in part on some family history, and I would love to know what the research component of it all looked like.
Oh yeah,
it's wonderful.
But before you do that, if you could give us a one sentence summary of the book from your perspective, and then dive into that.
Okay, well, this book, Across So Many Seas, it's about four girls living in four different time periods and four different places. And their stories all converge at the end of the book. And they are all of Sephardic ancestry. They're all Jewish, originally from Spain. And so they have that in common, the four girls. So I don't know if that's a good summary.
Yeah, I think that's very good.
Rough idea. So this book, I'd never written anything like it. So writing from four points of view, knowing from the beginning I would have four girls and knowing pretty much like who they would be and what time periods they would live in and what places. So I knew that much, but that's really not enough to write a book. You know, it's like, wait, what's going to happen to each of them? How are they each going to think and feel and experience the world? So it was really in the writing that I figured out who they were, or that they told me who they were as I was writing, which is the fun part about writing, is that whole discovery process that you go through. So this particular book, you mentioned Letters from Cuba, which is my earlier middle grade novel. That book was to honor my maternal grandmother, who was Polish and Jewish, and she immigrated to Cuba and brought the whole family afterwards. She worked really hard to bring everybody over right on the eve of World War II. So she really saved her mother and her siblings. And that was an incredible story on my mother's side of the family. But then on my father's side of the family, there was the other grandmother, the paternal grandmother, and she was completely different. So she was from Turkey, also Jewish, but with a completely different background, going back to Spain in the 15th century. And her story was interesting because I knew less of it. So I had to figure out more of it and make more of a story of it, because all we really know about her is that she was sent to Cuba from Turkey by her family and then never saw her family again. And she liked to sing old Spanish songs, and she played this Middle Eastern instrument called an oud, O-U-D. It's like a mandolin or a lute, and she played that instrument. And so that was pretty much what I knew. I didn't know much more than that. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to have to see what I can do with with this story. And that's what inspired me to write Across So Many Seas, but to give it a really like long time span. So rather than just writing about her life in the 20s and 30s in Turkey and in Cuba, I thought, no, we'll go all the way back to 1492, because we all have heard of 1492. We associate it with Columbus and, you know, the conquest of the Americas. So when we say 1492, I think most kids automatically, that's what we associate with 1492. But there's this other 1492, which is the time that Jewish people were expelled from Spain, and they had lived in Spain for about 1,000 years. Shortly thereafter, they also expelled Muslims who were living in Spain. So they expelled everybody who was different. And so I thought, well, let me take the story all the way back to 1492. Let me explore this other 1492 that's part of my grandmother's heritage and therefore part of my heritage. I'll start there just to see, like, how do we connect to something that has happened so long ago, 1492? How can that possibly have any connection with how we're living now in the present? So I had that on my mind. And so that's why I start in 1492. And then we go on to the story that's inspired by my grandmother in 1923 in Turkey. Then her daughter is Allegra. She's living in Cuba at the time of the Cuban Revolution in 1961. And then her daughter, or Reina's granddaughter, the Turkish grandmother, she's growing up in Miami in 2003 and feeling like she has the weight of all this history on her shoulders. So that's how the story came together for me.
That's so interesting. And I think that the certainly like the connection in more ways than one, like in the book, really, you bring it, do such a good job of bringing it out through things like, you know, this song that kind of gets passed through, like weaves through the book. And then even, you know, I won't spoil the ending for people listening, but the way that all four stories, you know, including all the way back to 1492, come together in the final chapter, which I was so delighted by, because I was reading it. I was like, I wasn't even expecting that. And here it is. And it was like, I don't know. This kind of delightful surprise. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned in your author's note about the big time jump between those first two girls, between, you know, 1492. And it was also interesting to me that when Bienvenida's family leaves Spain, they don't go to Turkey. They end up somewhere in Italy. And there's this sense at the end of her section that they'll have to leave soon again. But then, you know, we jump all the way to the 20th century. So was that like a decision made on necessity because of, you know, like lack of sources? Was it what you felt was right for the structure of the book?
Well, no, it was based on my research. I discovered that a lot of the people that left, you know, because they had the choice, they could convert to Christianity if they wanted to stay, to Catholicism in particular, if they wanted to stay in Spain. But if they wanted to maintain their faith, they had to leave. And so a lot of people didn't go directly to what would be, let's say, their final destination. They've stopped in other places on the way. And the route to Naples was a very common one. And I discovered, as has one of my cousins, that in my ancestry, in my DNA ancestry, I have Italian. I have some Italian background. So I thought, maybe some of the ancestors might have stopped in Naples or somewhere like that. So it was a common route to go to Naples, and then to find out later that that wasn't going to be a good place for a permanent home, and then go on from there. Some people went to Venice. So a lot of people did go via Italy and then go on eventually to what is now Turkey, or what was the Ottoman Empire at that time. So that's why I included it. I didn't want to make it too simple, like, okay, we left Spain and now here we are in the place where we're going to be for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. That seemed too simple. It was actually a much more complicated route. And other people went through North Africa to Morocco. Some went through Portugal. So there were all these different routes that people took to get out of Spain at that time, just trying to reach a port to be able to leave Spain.
You know, in journalism and podcasting, you should never ask yes or no questions. I am going to, but I'm going to follow it up immediately with a side question. And that would be that, you know, was this perhaps your most intensive experience, given all that, given the four narratives, given all the research, was it your most intensive creation process for a book? And if it was, what did you find most fulfilling about it?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And actually, I think it was definitely one of the most challenging projects I've ever assigned to myself.
Yeah.
Nobody told me to write this book.
And what made it worthwhile? That's the non-yes, no question.
I assigned this. This is an assignment I gave myself. I mean, I'm also a teacher, so sometimes I think, why do I assign these things to myself? So I assigned it to myself. I just thought, I love books that are told from different points of view and different characters. I just love those sorts of stories, but I had never written one like that. All my books before were first person. It was like the voice of the person going through the experience, telling the whole story. And then this one, I thought, well, let me try this. I know it's going to be challenging. Yeah. So I think it was just that I wanted to try to understand different points of view. And I liked the idea of different places at different times. And I thought that it would maybe more accurately show the way people have moved from place to place in this community, this diaspora. You know, it starts in one place and ends up in another. And each girl in the story is in a new place, in a new time, but she's inherited something of the girl or girls who came before. And I just thought, oh, that's so interesting. And it's what life is like for most of us. We inherit some things from our parents and our grandparents, maybe our great grandparents, but a lot gets lost as well. So I think about this a lot. I think, I wonder what my mother was like when she was 12. And she can tell me some things, but I'll never be able to experience my mother at the age of 12. I would have to write fiction to imagine that. So I think that's what I find fulfilling about it, is just trying to imagine life at different times. You know, this is what I love about historical fiction. It's like, oh, can I imagine who my grandmother might have been at age 12? It's not going to be her exactly, but I can create a story to try to imagine her.
Yes.
So I think that's very fulfilling. Like, can I do that? It's just kind of, it's the journey of the imagination, which is always such a fun journey to take.
Wow. Yeah. Do you see that as sort of the, not that, because I know you're a professor of anthropology, and not that academic work isn't in its way also creative, but I'm interested that in addition to that work, you know, you also write children's literature. And I was wondering how you, you know, what connection you see between those things, because it feels like there is one, you know, having read some of your works, like, right. I can tell, and in the best way possible, I'm like, ah, yes, this was written by an anthropologist. Yeah. And I think is interested in a lot of the questions that the anthropology is interested in, like, you know, the movement of people and what do we make out of the places that we're in and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way, maybe I had to be an anthropologist to write this book, you know, precisely because of the things you just said. Like, I'm interested in heritage, in culture, how do things get passed on from one generation to another? I mean, a lot of us are interested in that. You don't have to be an anthropologist to be interested in those topics, but anthropologists are definitely obsessive about them and very interested in culture, you know, very interested in like cultural traditions and like how do they get passed on, but also how do people innovate on the traditions that they've already, you know, known from childhood. So those kinds of questions really interest me. And then I really, I'm very interested in places. You know, as an anthropologist, I've lived in Spain, I've lived in Mexico, I've gone back to Cuba many times where I was born. I've gone to other places as well, but those have been like my three major ones. And I did actually go to Turkey once too, and I got to see where my grandmother lived in Turkey. So the places are really important to me. I think that comes from my anthropology as well, that anthropologists get very excited about the places where they spend time and get to know people very closely through hanging out with them. So I think all of that in some way is revealed in this book and my other books as well. In Letters from Cuba, that story was set in a small town in Cuba, in the sugar growing town where my mother's family actually lived. And being the anthropologist, like, I had to go to that town and see it for myself, and spent a couple of days there living with a family in that town and just getting to know it. So I think getting to know like people and places on the ground, like firsthand, is very important. And I think for this book, a lot of that background is in the book as well. I'm writing about places that I know. I'm writing about Spain, a place that I've been going to, you know, since I was like 20 years old. I've been traveling to Spain and living in a small village there. So I feel like that's the anthropology comes in through that sense of place, and then through that interest in culture and tradition. And you mentioned song before too, like the songs, the music, the poetry, like those are all things that interest me as an anthropologist, but they also interest me as a writer. And fortunately, my colleagues at the University of Michigan have been very understanding about, you know, the fact that I write in more than one genre, that I do anthropology work, but that I'm also writing fiction. And when I wrote my first middle grade novel, Lucky Broken Girl, I was really touched that several of my colleagues who have children, or at the time had children that were, you know, middle grade, they asked me to sign the book for their kids. And I thought, oh, that's really sweet.
I'll be devil's advocate, since I'm not a children's author or a children's librarian. I'm a grown up who's lost touch with his inner child. So I'll just ask a very potentially asinine question on its face and say, Ruth, why write to a younger audience when you perhaps could, you know, write books for grouchy grown ups like me? What compels you to write to a younger reader? What makes that fulfilling for you?
Well, it's really exciting to have a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old, you know, pick up your book and read it. There's just something so amazing. And I'm sure your inner child is still
hopefully.
There.
Hopefully.
Not completely lost. I know my inner child is still there. And so partly I'm writing for that child that I was, maybe the child that was understood to some extent, but wasn't understood totally. And so I'm trying to write to that child, write some of the stories that I didn't get to hear, when I was young. So part of it is that. And then the other part is that now that I've written 3 middle grade novels and I've had a chance to talk to a lot of kids, it's just really exciting when they connect with your story. I mean, when you look at they're both young and old at the same time, like a middle grade child, you think they're just 10 or 11 or 12. They're so young, but they're so mature at the same time. They can read so much, and they have, just really good attention, I think, to stories as well. So I find it really exciting when they like something that I've written. A teacher just wrote to me and said, oh, my students are reading Letters from Cuba and they're so enthralled with the story. I'm going, oh my God, really? It's just very, very exciting. So all I can say is that I just really appreciate that there's young people reading books who want to learn about these stories. There's just something very fulfilling about writing for that audience. I mean, I will also continue to write for adults and hope to write some fiction for adults one day too, but and ethnography and essays and some of the other genres that I write in. But there's something just really amazing about knowing that a young person can pick up something that I've written and be able to understand it and connect with it. Mm-hmm. It's just it's sort of like healing your own inner child in a certain way.
You're absolutely right about middle graders being so old and so young at the same time. We do, for our 5th grade students at the public upper elementary school, every year we do a battle of the books, a trivia kind of tournament for them, and your books are on the short list for next year, because we pick 6 books, and one a recent favorite, we did this one 2 or 3 years ago, I think, was When Stars Are Scattered, which is a graphic novel about Somalian refugees. And I mean, and it's heavy stuff, understandably, and these kids loved it. I have parents who come in who are like, my son handed me this book and was like, Mom, you have to read it. And we all read it together. And there's something about, I think that there's, particularly in the cultural climate right now, this perception that, children have to be protected from everything and aren't ready for heavy stories and things like that, which ask most children about their actual lives. Sure. And you'll find out that that's not true.
If not now, when?
And I can absolutely imagine that there's something so fulfilling, because I think your books do this very well of there's heavy stuff in Across the Many Seas. There's heavy stuff. I mean, so many of your books are predicated, even something like Tia Fortuna's New Home, which I can see behind you, is predicated on somebody having to leave and go somewhere else. And that in and of itself is often a huge trauma.
Sure.
of having to leave your home and everything that you know. And so, I think our 5th graders would connect with these books so hard.
And I feel like a grown-up, like my metaphoric self could connect with this.
Yes.
In a book like this.
Yes.
There's
also
something for them here.
What Jeff is not telling you is that he's our resident punster.
Yeah.
This man is almost entirely inner child.
Sure.
In his real life. he's doing a very serious podcasting persona right now.
Yes.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing about middle grade or this age group is that, they're both, like you were just saying, young and old, but also on the cusp of adulthood, but not there yet. Mm-hmm. So they also have, a certain maturity, but also this tremendous innocence mm-hmm. at the same time, and a kind of hopefulness, I think, that's very different from when you become a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're so dreary about everything, and the gloomy teenager and so on. So you're at that stage where, you're aware of so much, but there's still a basic optimism and hope, mm-hmm. Hopefulness about humanity. That's also just very, very refreshing. And I think it's nice, again, to write for that age group because of that, and because they're going to try to see the bright side of things, even when, as you said, you're sharing very, dark kinds of stuff with them.
Yeah.
Do you find that each book you write over the last 7, 8 plus years kind of teaches you something new, not even just the reader, but even you take something away from the whole experience once the story is all told?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think when I go back to Lucky Broken Girl, which is based on my own story of being in a body cast for a year, in, you know, when I was growing up in New York. So there, you know, I thought a lot about healing and the importance of community. You know, I think at the time when I went through that experience, when I was, you know, 9, 10 years old, it was very kind of focused on me. It was very narcissistic. It was like, I'm going through this terrible experience. This is the worst thing in the world. And I think when I wrote the book, I realized that I couldn't have gotten through the experience, and my character in the book, Ruthie, couldn't have gotten through the experience without a community, without her family, the neighbors, the friends, even the doctor, the nurse, the physical therapist, you know, I mean, you know, even the guys that brought her back and forth on the stretcher from the ambulance to the hospital. I mean, everybody cared about this child. And I think that's something that I didn't totally realize until I wrote the book and started to see like what characters needed to be in the story. And then I realized, you know, she had a lot of help. Without all this help and without all this care from other people, she wouldn't have healed. And I think that's something that I didn't realize when I started writing the book. And certainly I didn't realize when I was going through the experience as a child. I think I was just very focused on myself. So I think that's something that I learned. And I think similarly with Letters from Cuba, there too, the community in this small rural town in Cuba helps Esther and her father, and they you know, they welcome them to their town and to their community, even though they're different, they're strangers, they're from Poland, you know, nothing to do with Cuba, but, you know, they bring them into the community. There's one very evil person in the town, but the town kind of, you know, comes together to support them and to help them. So I think that's something that, again, I might not have realized before until I started writing it and figuring out like what's going to happen to this girl in this town in Cuba. And then with this book, I think here I feel like I learned, you asked me the question about writing a book like this from four points of view. And yeah. I think here what I learned is that I could write this book from four points of view. It wasn't something that I thought I could do until I tried it. So I think from a craft perspective, I learned new things. You know, I never got an MFA in creative writing, but I feel like writing these books has been a way of kind of earning my MFA. I've sort of learned it by doing, mm-hmm. and maybe by making a lot of mistakes. But I've, you know, found a way to tell these stories that I really want to tell.
Oh yeah, you're putting in your 10,000 hours for sure.
Yeah, and you write for even younger readers as well. We've sort of mentioned off the cuff, like Tia Fortuna's New Home, and I feel like, do you have a second picture book? Am I imagining
that? I do. So I have another one that I co-wrote with my son, Gabriel, and Gabriel Frey-Behar, who was born and raised in Ann Arbor. He's now in New York, but he's a Michigander. And we wrote a book together, a picture book that came out last year called Pepita Meets Bebita. And Pepita is this very sweet dog, and she's got to get used to a new little person in the family who's the Bebita, the baby. So it's all told from the dog's perspective and how she's struggling because she's not getting all the attention that she used to get before the Bebita came into the household.
I'll have to make sure that we have that one. Those books always go over very well here.
Mm-hmm. Well, anybody who loves dogs or anybody who has a new baby in the family, a lot of kids have loved the book who have a younger sibling, mm-hmm. and they're dealing with that relationship. They've really, really enjoyed the book. And I also have, I can send you some activity sheets that kids can work on too that go with that book.
Oh, yeah.
They get into it. Yeah.
You know, I certainly see a lot of books behind you on a bookshelf, and we are podcasting to you from public library. I have to imagine that libraries played a pretty significant role in your life, or that you must have been a big library fan yourself.
Absolutely. I grew up in Queens, New York, and I often went to the Queens Public Library. What I also remember vividly, before that, we lived in a different neighborhood where the library wasn't nearby, but there was a bookmobile that would come. And that was totally magical to me and to other kids on the block. We just couldn't believe that this bookmobile would come, and we would go inside the bookmobile and grab books. And then after that, started going to the library. And then when I was a teenager and I could go by myself, I'd go by myself to the Queens Public Library. And it was definitely an amazing experience. I loved books. I came to love books during that year that I was in the body cast, because I couldn't go outside and play. I'd been a very active little girl, but then I played a lot of hopscotch, but then had to be in bed. But we had a tutor who came to the house, that my school in New York sent a tutor to the house, a teacher, and she brought a lot of books. So I was surrounded by books and fell in love with books. And then after that, I became a really strong, very strong bookworm, and really needed books all the time.
And you wind up in anthropology. Now you've lived all over the world, and now you're in Michigan, which is wonderful. You're naming such exquisite and sometimes exotic places, and romantic places, frankly. I've lived in Michigan all my life, so now I'm almost like, of course, I love it, but I do often wonder what others think of it. How do you find Michigan? How do you find Ann Arbor? What do you think of it?
I like it. I like Ann Arbor a lot. I like Michigan. I've traveled a bit through the state of Michigan, so I've gotten to know some, maybe not every place, but yeah, definitely know a lot of places in Michigan. I think for a long time, I felt a little bit like a foreigner in Michigan. I think having, you know, been born in Cuba, growing up in New York, you know, Michigan was so different. So I think it took me a long time to get used to it. But I think raising a son in Michigan, I think definitely like made me feel that I was home. Yeah. And definitely Ann Arbor is a place I really love. Love the community here, the students, and just the whole town and all the possibilities of things. I can even dance salsa, you know, here in Arbor. So, in fact, I plan to dance bachata tonight. So I love the fact that, you know, kind of everything is available here. You just have to kind of know where to look. But there's so many incredible resources, cultural and artistic and intellectual and just social resources. And I love that very, very much.
An incredible public library, too.
Yes. Yeah.
An incredible public library as well. Absolutely. Yeah.
Congrats again on the book. Any, like, are you working on another one already, or do you have any things you're looking forward to in the year ahead?
Yes. Well, I am working on another middle grade novel right now, as well as another picture book.
Nice.
So the picture book, there's a whole draft of it now, and hoping that will move forward. There's a picture book, another picture book that I co-wrote with my son, Gabriel, that's also kind of in the works. So I've got those. I don't want to share titles or
sure
topics yet. I'm a little superstitious about that until they're actually like, you know, like in press. I don't really like to mention them. And then I'm working on a middle grade novel that, at least for the moment, I'm hoping it's going to be a verse novel. So I'm writing it as a verse novel because I really love poetry. And I've read some amazing verse novels that have been really, really, really inspiring, by Jackie Woodson, Margarita Engel, among others. And and I really want to try out that style, too. So those are some of my upcoming projects.
Oh, that's very exciting. I have a Ghosts of Rose Hill waiting on my bookshelf, which is another novel in verse that I feel like they're having a moment now. Like, they're really, really, there are a lot of really good ones. I have one quick story I wanted to tell about when we got our copy of Tia Fortuna in for the first time. In the youth department, we, even though we split the ordering between librarians, everything when it comes in goes on a cart so we can see what just came in so that we know what we can recommend to folks. And one of my coworkers was looking at Tia Fortuna and the illustrations and noticed the evil eye bracelets that she wears. And she noticed, because I have one as well that my friend Alana gave me. And so she noticed, she was like, oh, that's same deal. And I was like, yes. And in fact, the friend who just gave me this just interviewed Ruth for Kirkus, and and so it's a nice little connection, and I think it's something I see in so many of your books are those connections between people or places or the things that tie us together. So Alana Bensusan asked me to send her love.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I remember her really well. I remember talking to her very much. Oh, that is so nice. Yeah. That's so lovely. Wow. Thank you. And I think I just showed you that I have my bracelets here as well. I don't know if you could see those, but.
Oh, beautiful.
Keep the evil eye away. My
bracelets from Turkey. So I've got them. I can't imagine not having them. So.
Yeah, I don't take mine off. And either. Every time Alana's in Boston, I'm here. Every time we see each other, she's like, "Hey," and I'm like, "Yeah, it doesn't leave my wrist. It stays here. Of course, I'm wearing it every time I see you." So,
oh, that's lovely. It's wonderful. We all connect. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, I just only have one more quick question. Since I know Mary Graham is a big fan of historical fiction, we have kind of touched on this. What makes it all worthwhile? But for any folks out there who think they might want to write their own historical fiction one day, do you have any advice for them?
I do. I mean, I think you have to be the kind of, if you're a young person and you're thinking about this now, you want to be the kind of young person that's interested in the stories of the elders. You know, so I think like these two books, you know, they're both inspired by my grandmother's. And that's because I was always curious, even if I didn't get the full story. You know, I was curious about them. I spent, particularly my maternal grandmother, I was always spending time with her and wanting to hear her stories. And the same with my grandfathers. I haven't written about them, but I was close to them as well. But I was always that kind of child that, you know, would go up to an elder and say, "Oh, like, how did that happen to you? Or how did you get to Cuba? Why did we come from Cuba to here?" You know, I was always curious to know their stories and kind of to know, like, how I came to be here. Like, you know, what did everybody before me have to do for me to get to where I am now? So I was always curious that way. So I think for historical fiction, it's good to awaken that curiosity from the time you're young. And nowadays, it's so easy to record people's stories, you know, just with a cell phone. You can just use the voice memo app and you can record a story, but you can also write notes down, you know, in a notebook and have, you know, an elder tell you a story. If it's not somebody in your own family, maybe it's a neighbor or a friend of the family or something like that. But I think just being curious about everything that's come before you and to know that the ones that came before us also have stories and they had dreams and hopes, and just to become aware of that, I think that can like nurture the sort of inner resources that you need to write historical fiction.
Marvelous. Ruth Behar, thanks so much for joining us on our little podcast here. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a joy.
Thank you both. It's been great to be here with you. Thank you.
You have a lot of fans here in the youth department. And that was our chat with Ruth Behar, coming to us from the campus of University of Michigan. Wasn't that amazing?
That was awesome. I am so glad that she was able to join us. It is, I have to say, like, always exciting because, listener, I mean, so much of the way that this podcast gets made is that I pop up over Jeff's cubicle wall and I do a little jump scare.
Yeah.
He goes, "Ah, you again."
Yeah, and I spill my coffee.
Yeah, and I say, "I just read a book. It was really good. I need to talk to this author." So
that's right.
Can you make that happen?
Across the many seas.
Literally every time he says yeah.
Yeah, because this episode will be out before our next one, but we can kind of preview in this little outro here that Sasha Lamb is going to be coming on the podcast, author of
When the Angels Left the Old Country, which you may remember, listener, because I know you've listened to every episode of the pod, as my favorite book that I read in 2023.
Yeah.
It was my favorite book. We will be joined by my colleague, Aaron, who is the one who shoved it into my hands. Mm-hmm. And it's a great month for Jewish literature on the pod, Jeff. What a joy.
So, folks, stay tuned. You can find out more about the author we just interviewed at ruthbehar.com. That link will be in our show notes, of course. That'll do it for another episode of A Little Too Quiet. And you've listened to it, and hopefully you've loved it. I know you loved it. Mary Graham, thanks for joining me.
Thanks as always, Jeff.
Thanks as always, of course, to John Duffy for giving us music and to the Friends of the Ferndale Library for making this podcast a reality. If you want to find more information about how you can support this podcast, go to ferndalefriends.org. But remember also to rate, review, and subscribe. We will be back next week with more. Thanks for listening.